Welcome. You're listening to the Leadership Intensive Training Podcast. Every week, we'll equip you with all the tools you'll need to become a strong leader within your campus ministry. We look forward to seeing you grow and making disciples here at Yale.
Welcome, everyone, to today's session on servant leadership. For over 20 years, CBS has produced the show Survivor. It's a reality TV show that seeks to prove the Darwinian idea that the fittest will ultimately survive. Now, watching reality TV of any kind has a similar premise that we all know too well and which usually fits the Survivor storyline. You get a few dozen people on a desert island, you pit them against each other for a large sum of money, and then you sit back and wait to see what happens. And so on Survivor, the eager contestants arrive at their destination and are put into two teams. And for weeks, it can appear as though there is very little conflict outside of the team, because your individual goal is to make sure that your team drives ahead. However, as many of us have seen, at some point, the team approach breaks down, and individuals who had fought for one another just 1 week prior are now ripping each other apart, verbally and physically. Now, when outsiders begin to commentate on the program, there are various responses. Network producers usually raise, innocent hands saying, "It's not our fault. It's not our fault." The social psychologists pull out the nature versus nurture debate, making us wonder yet again whether humans have any good in them at all, right? And the family members back home defend and defend and defend, saying, "You don't understand. Our Davey is really a nice guy." Now, consider this. After 23 contestants have been voted off the island, would you call the remaining winner a successful leader? Now, on the one hand, he or she was able to outwit and outmatch all the other contestants. So maybe what Machiavelli said in The Prince was true. It is better to be feared than loved if you can't be both. But if that's true, then leadership in any capacity has an intrinsically selfish posture. It's not about us. It's about me. It's not about our victory. It's my dominance. Now, play that out one or two steps and we see a world we fear, where people use each other for position or pleasure or promotion. Because when our personal needs or success are paramount, then anything goes. And while it may never get as physically violent as it usually does on Survivor, the results of our selfish actions invite a tsunami of broken trust, crushing words, and disposable relationships. We may not have physical bruises, but our souls are ruined. Today, we're going to challenge that motive, and we'll play it out one or two steps. We're going to look at leadership, specifically what it means to be a servant leader, and question whether or not selfish ambition is the only option. To do that, we're going to look at Paul's letter to the Christian community in Philippi. So let's begin reading in chapter 2, verse 1. "So if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you not look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. He emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father." Paul has a lot to say here about who Jesus is and how we should think and live like him. And as we learned last week, we need to read the Bible in context. So let me give you a little background on how we understand the divinity of Jesus in order to see the fullness of what Paul is trying to say to them in Philippi and then subsequently to us. One of the dominating conversations among Christian leaders in the first century was about Jesus's humanity. And the question was, is Jesus fully God or fully man, or some combination of both? In 325 AD, a group of Christian theologians met at the Council of Nicaea and determined that Jesus was both fully God and fully man. That means that we can't look at Jesus and say, well, he wasn't really God, Therefore, he has nothing eternal to say about my life, because his death and resurrection accomplished a task of redemption that we could never accomplish in our own power. But we also can't look at Jesus and say, he has no idea what I'm going through. Because have you ever had someone ridicule you or misunderstand you? Well, so has Jesus. Have you ever been betrayed by a friend or gone hungry? So has Jesus. Have you ever been ashamed? Jesus died alone and naked on a cross. And yet at the same time, have you ever made a friend who knows you completely and still loves you, still fights for you? Those were the kinds of relationships Jesus developed with others. Therefore, Jesus has experienced the breadth and the depth of what it means to be human, and yet because he is fully God, he was able to redeem humanity once and for all. And that plan, to come as a human, experience our world firsthand, and then die to save us, was the plan from the beginning. Listen to how the prophet Isaiah prophesied about Jesus hundreds of years before his birth. This is in Isaiah 53:4-6. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we were healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Here's the point of the history lesson. From the beginning of time, God had a rescue plan for humanity, but possibly even more incredible was that rescue plan included his own life, his very heart. God did not send a moral code for you and I so that we could try and follow it and then save ourselves. He sent himself. And yet there's more. It wasn't just that God always had a plan or that Jesus would fulfill the mission, but Jesus chose to fulfill a mission to save people who were not looking for him, who didn't have a thought of him, who didn't even care about him. I mean, look at how Paul describes that in his letter to the Romans. This is Romans 5:6-8. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So what does that mean? Well, when Paul is writing to the Philippians, he is telling them the story of Jesus, namely how Jesus thought about us and chose to act on our behalf out of his all-consuming, never-fading love for us. But there's more, because Paul is not just telling a story about Jesus, he's telling a story about us, who we are to God and how we are called to live. And now we find ourselves back at the beginning. What does it all mean? If we were to play it out one or two steps, how is Jesus asking us to live as servant leaders? To play that out, I want us to look at two ways Jesus thinks and lives, and then make some points pertaining to how he thinks and lives. See if we can get on a similar path. So first, Jesus changes how we understand power. Now, imagine you had been born into wealth, but let's say not just wealth, but maybe power. Maybe we were born into a monarchy that had reigned for hundreds of years. Now, that reality would ascribe you certain benefits. You would probably never worry about hunger. You could choose any line of profession or to not work at all. And you would socialize with the influential people of the world. That power would give you the freedom to treat others how you please, since you had no reliance on them. Now, regardless of whether or not you were a good or bad leader, you still had that measure of control. The political powers during the reign of Jesus in the first century often treated others with a similar contempt, with a disregard. For example, the beheading of John the Baptist, recorded by Matthew, is the result of a multitude of sins and power plays. Herod, who was a local political governor, was sleeping with his husband's wife. And when John the Baptist challenged that behavior, Herod had John the Baptist in prison. Now, soon after that, Herod has a party where a young, beautiful woman dances for him. And Herod is so aroused by her dancing that he tells her that he will give her whatever she wants. Now, understand the point. Herod believed every wish was at his disposal. Now, the girl asks for John the Baptist to be beheaded and for his head to be presented on a platter. And Herod immediately regrets that she has made this request, but grants it anyway to save face in front of his guests. So when Paul in Philippians 2:6 says that Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, he's talking about Jesus's use of power. Now remember, Jesus had all the power in the world. He was 100% man, but he was also 100% God. And Jesus could have wielded that power for personal glory, fame, or just to buff his own ego. But instead, he feeds the hungry, he heals the sick, and he seeks out people who are spiritually, emotionally, and relationally lost, like the Samaritan woman in John 4. In doing so, Jesus demonstrates this principle, that leveraging your power to serve others is an act of love. So how could we do that? How would we leverage our power to serve others? Well, first, we have to give up the idea that we're owed something. Now, at times, we feel like we're owed lots of things. I mean, we can feel like we are owed a night home binge-watching Netflix if we worked hard all week, or maybe an entire week of ice cream if we finally finished finals. But we can also feel like we're owed the right to focus on our personal pursuits because we want to be able to pursue the things that we want, that we can ignore the needs of others. Or at least we feel like we have the right to assume that it's somebody else's responsibility if we feel like what we have on our agenda seems more important. Yet Jesus, the one with all the power and the only person who really deserves glory, said, "Whoever would be great among you must be a servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So when we internalize the idea that we are not owed something, we are beginning to think like Jesus. And when we start to serve others, we leverage our power to love them, and we start acting like Jesus. And to act like Jesus, I think we need to live out the golden rule. We do for others as we would have them do for us. Now, maybe this doesn't reflect you, but I bet there are some first years out there who got to school and met their FROCO and their dean and their hawk and joined 15 groups and took too many classes and thought to themselves, this feels good. This feels right. Or at least it looks like what everybody else is doing. But if it's at all possible, if you were a first year like that, then I bet you got to a point where you realized that sometimes the hype is just hype. And you were lonely and you were anxious about work and you weren't sure if you'd gotten involved with the right things. And you know, who are these people that you're getting to know? But a servant leader who's an upperclassman doesn't look at that first year student and think, well, we all had to go through it. Now it's your turn. Instead, a servant leader would go out of his or her way to get to know that first year and to sacrifice time to sit and work with them, maybe even sacrifice a Friday night to help other first years get to know each other and make friends and help them out practically by getting them stuff for their dorm or taking them to the grocery store. They would sacrifice themselves instead of saying, well, now you've got to go through the muck too. And I know what you might be thinking. Well, but do they really need that from me? I mean, don't I deserve some time with my friends? Don't I deserve my Friday night for myself? And I think you might see where we're going here, because giving up your rights or giving up what you think you deserve is sacrifice. But because Jesus made a sacrifice on our behalf, even when we weren't thinking about him, we can find the motivation to do the same for someone who maybe isn't thinking or looking for us. So, what Jesus teaches us about servant leadership is that we need to leverage our power to love and serve others, both by realizing that we aren't owed something and then by living out the golden rule. But the second thing Jesus teaches us is that he changes the way we understand our relationships. If we begin to think and act as Jesus does, that we aren't owed anything and that love means sacrifice, then we are on our way towards taking up Paul's next challenge, which is think of others more than yourself. Now, the irony is that to think well of others, you first actually have to think about yourself. And here's what I mean. Well, what's the difference between a thermometer and a thermostat? Now, one takes the temperature and the other sets the temperature. And most, if not all, of the leaders that you love and admire have learned how to live like thermostats. They know how to set the temperature of their attitude in order to love others. You've probably all been in a work group or on a team where a member of the group wears their heart on their sleeve. And the issue is not that emotions are bad or that we shouldn't talk openly about them or what we're thinking or feeling, but it can be poor leadership to never adjust your attitude and allow other people to just suffer your bad mood. And you know how hard that can be if you have somebody that does that in a work group or a member of a group that you're trying to participate in. To bow out of responsibilities because you just don't feel like it, or to not adjust to the moment, is poor leadership. Because all discipline requires us to push past what we feel to show up for where we are needed, and to show up with a desire to serve rather than to be served. So here's what that might look like in our relationships: to live like a thermostat, not a thermometer, and to think about others more than ourselves. First, I think we need to tell people they're valuable. You know, all people are valuable to God. Because we are valuable to Him, He finds ways to love us both in words and actions. And at times, loving others with actions feels like the lesser threat, because it may feel easier to offer a free meal to someone rather than look them in the eye and tell them why they're important, what you believe about them, the things that you see them growing in as a person and with Christ, or how even you felt just so close to them when they showed up and sat with you when you felt overwhelmed. But when we begin to honor one another by telling them verbally why they are valuable, then we begin to think and act like Jesus. But the second thing that I can believe that we can begin to demonstrate to think of others more than ourselves is to show up ready to listen. You know, there is a common misconception that leaders need to be loud, charismatic, funny to a fault, always good in front of a crowd. But that's not true in Christian communities, nor is it true of some of the greatest CEOs in the nation. Greatest leaders have an uncanny ability to listen. They look people in the eye, they eliminate distractions, and they think about what they're hearing. I think that's one reason why Jesus was always able to ask such good questions. It's easy to know what to ask of a person if you've been really listening. So if we were going to think of others more than ourselves, I think we need to show them they're valuable, show up ready to listen. But finally, we have to go five extra steps, five more steps. When I was a freshman in college, my core group leader and I lived on the same floor in my dorm. She was just three doors down from mine. And in the first semester of college, she traveled the extra five steps to my room on a regular basis and would always ask me about my day. She was a constant presence of joy in my life. And she would show up at my door when it was time for core group and walk me the five steps back to her room. Now, she was a junior when I was a first year. She was really well-known and well-liked on campus. She had a full life, but she never seemed too busy for me. In my second semester, I started traveling the five steps to her room without her coming to get me. She had sought me out even before I knew I needed what she was offering, and therefore she was becoming like my hero. I wanted to be like her. I wanted to lead like her and know why she lived the way she did. All it took to change my life forever was for her to walk five extra steps. So if we want to think and live like Jesus and have more meaningful relationships than we ever thought possible, we need to think of others more than ourselves by checking our attitude, giving people value, learning how to listen, and going five more steps. So now we come to the end. What would a life of servant leadership offer us? Well, if you've been listening well, what you've heard me say is that Jesus modeled servant leadership as a lifestyle. That lifestyle is the way that we can honor God with our lives by learning to think and act as He would. And if we do, it means that we model radical sacrifice. We ask the question, how can I serve you, before asking, how can I be served? And we leverage our power, sometimes at the point of giving up our rights or our preferences, so that someone else can grow and thrive. And we do it all because Jesus did it for us. He didn't just come and show us a nice way to live. He died the death we should have died because of His all-consuming, never-fading love for us. Let me be clear. If you want to be a mature Christian disciple, you will need to live a life of sacrifice. You will need to find new ways to choose joy. And you will need to think of others more than yourself. But there's one more lesson before we're done, because this letter to the Christians in Philippi is known for a few things. It's known for the passage that we just looked at, but it's also known for its joy, because the Philippians were actually known as a community of joy. And here's why that's important, because every once in a while, a student will come to me who's anxious, looking for a better life, the good life. And often when I'm in that discussion, I'll ask him or her about their community, how they spend their time, because those are usually good questions in that moment. But I think there's always a third essential question, which is this: how are you giving your life away? And I ask that because we are often duped into thinking that if we protect our interests, if we make sure that we're not convenienced in any way, that nothing makes us tired or stressed in serving others, if we focus our energy on our own needs, that we'll achieve this inner sanctum. And here's the thing, the Philippians weren't duped. They knew that following Christ and becoming mature would ask something of them. And yet, because they were willing to sacrifice, because they had unity in their community and thought of others more than themselves, in short, because they were giving their lives away, they ultimately found joy. And that works just because God's kingdom is the upside down kingdom that works differently than we think the world should work. And so when we commit ourselves to servant leadership like this and to live and to act like Jesus, I promise you, on the other side of sacrifice, on the other side of giving up your rights, on the other side of serving others and thinking of others more than yourself, you're going to find that it is far more rewarding than you could ever imagine to see what God can do in you and what God can do through you. You'll become people of genuine joy. And you're people of joy in my life. And so I want to speak the prayer that Paul spoke over the Philippians as we close this teaching. He said this in Philippians 1, 3 through 6. I thank my God every time I remember you. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus.
You've been listening to the Leadership Intensive Podcast. We'll see you next week.